started.
Okay, thank you very much. So I will be explaining the techniques for computing amplitudes quite basically from the start. So this will include a bit of a review of some of the ideas introduced yesterday in Mima's talk. So we're going to also make contact with Feynman diagrams. So eventually we're not going to want to compute with Feynman diagrams, but just so that we know we're computing the same things that we would be computing from Feynman diagrams, we're going to
20th century.
See them in this talk. Yeah, so in fact, a brief outline. I'll talk about the color decomposition in a bit more detail. So first, color disappears. Then, yeah, I think I don't need to say too much more about Spinner-Helicity formalism, but just briefly, we'll watch the polarization vectors disappear. I'll show some examples and identities. So this will be most of this morning's talk, and this is all basically 1980s technology. So we'll be caught up to the 1980s, and then perhaps by the end, we'll introduce the BCFW recursion, and then we'll work more with that in the afternoon and see what we can use it for. A few references from here too. So I think an excellent new reference is the new lecture notes by Michael Peskin, which covers really this material and also BCFW recursion relations and has lots of nice examples.
Covers the first 10 minutes.
Okay, and then there is an older one that I grew up with, the Dixon's Tassi lectures from 96, so, but I still refer to them all the time. So I have to mention them here. And then another one I would like to mention is Witten's paper on twister string theory. Also, for the review of this material, I would say, actually, section two only. Only the first half of section two is a very sort of nice, elegant mathematical introduction to spinners and helicity and applications for amplitudes. So I recommend that as well. All right, so I'll be working entirely with gluon amplitudes. They're the simplest. We use them in Yang-Mills theory, also in QCD. So to start us off, yeah, originally we had the quantum numbers of color and momentum and polarization. So first we're going to watch the color disappear. So to review the SUN color structure of these amplitudes, okay, very simply we had the cubic and the quartic interaction vertices with their color labels. And what enters then in the Feynman diagrams are these structure constants. Okay, this represents some kinematic factors. Because I'm just concerned with color at the moment. Vaguely representing the ST and U channels. Okay, and then we have, of course, the propagator with a delta function and the color indices. Okay, so the structure constants are defined by the algebra. Let's see, C1 algebra. So these TE are the traceless Hermitian N by N matrices. So A runs from 1 to n squared minus 1. And, okay, to, if we're going to be careful, then we agree to normalize them just with a delta function. All right, now as we build up our amplitude from Feynman diagrams and keep track of all these color interactions, for all the vertices, we pick up the structure constants, and then the whole product of structure constants that you get in a different, in a given diagram, will start to be merged by the Fierdze identity. So first of all, from this defining equation of the structure constants, you can express them in terms of the generators. Okay, and then the traces get merged with the Fierdze identity. Which takes this form. Now, when we do this, so you have various structure constants. Whenever you have the propagator, then you pick up these delta functions, which set these labels to be identical in a full sum. And then that gets replaced by this difference of two terms. Now, in SUN, all the 1 over n terms will drop out. And this is because we're in SUN, and this represents the subtraction of the trace that is the difference between UN and SUN. And the U1 photon would not couple to the gluons by color. So in effect, I mean, a shortcut, although it would work out anyway, is just to take this first term to collect your traces. One can also draw color flow diagrams to keep track of this Fierdze identity pictorially. Put it here. So we use these sort of gluon type lines for adjoint indices and quark type lines for fundamentals or anti-fundamentals. So then the gluon propagator well, here it is, but it's the adjoint which carries a fundamental and an anti-fundamental index. So this, yeah, the propagator can be written in terms of its fundamental indices like this, and then the pictorial depiction of this Fierdze identity that would be written as so. So you can do this in your diagram. And what you see from this operation is that your gluon propagator gets replaced by the kind of color flow that connects the diagram. The 1 over n term that will eventually drop out is the kind of color flow that disconnects the diagram. So by following the color flow, you'd find that at tree level, you just get a total single trace. All the color factors are combined nicely into one single trace, because if there were a contribution where your traces somehow were grouped into two or more, that would have been from the 1 over n terms, which drop out. Also, color flow is nice because you can easily include quarks or fundamental matter if you want. So I'm going to show the color decomposition for gluons because I'm talking about gluons, but it's easily adapted. If you want to calculate an amplitude with some quarks, you do the same operation and you'll get maybe some different kinds of trace structure, but it's the same idea. So at tree level, let me write this down. Talking about gluons now. We have the color trace, and then what's left over is so far a function of, momenta and polarizations, eventually spinners and helicity, let's say kinematics. So this is what's called then the color ordered partial amplitude, which when we're done with color will just be what we call the amplitude. We're going to be very interested in calculating these things in terms of kinematics. Then to get the full amplitude back, you just attach the color factor in this way. We have the quotient by Zn because of the cyclically invariant property of the trace. At one loop, you would have single trace terms and double trace terms. And it turns out that they're not independent either. So eventually at one loop, you can see that these kinds of color flow propagators as you go around the loop. Double trace term or the single trace term, and then your gluons can be attached anywhere here. So for one loop, which I won't be discussing anymore further, we would normally calculate the single trace term as well, and also the leading color contribution. And then if we want, we could reconstruct the subleading color contribution just in terms of the leading color contribution. So the upshot now, of course, with having this trace structure is that we look at the cyclically distinct orderings. And really just then planar partial amplitudes. So for example, if I'm looking at a 4-point gluon amplitude, I would have 6 partial amplitudes at this point to consider. Any questions? It will turn out that these 6 partial amplitudes are then related by other identities as well. All right, so at this point, We've done the color decomposition. We're ready to work with partial amplitudes only, and these now can be computed in terms of color-ordered Feynman rules. So now the feature of these color-ordered Feynman rules is that, like the amplitudes we're going to compute, everything is now planar. So we know what the cyclic ordering is. So this one doesn't look much different from before. We've dropped the coupling constants as well. In the quartic vertex, there is no momentum dependence. And so, yeah, certainly this is less symmetric than it used to be because now, you know, we know which ones are adjacent and which ones are not adjacent. Finally, then the propagator. Since I'm just going to work with gluons, let me leave it at this for now. So again, if we were looking at an example, n equals 4 gluon amplitude, now we actually have more diagrams than we did before because of the color decomposition. Oh, no, wait, that's not. No, sorry, we have. Okay. Okay, when I draw the diagrams just in terms of the topologies, of course, it's not going to look like more diagrams. But we have to take into account the different ways of labeling the legs as well. So for each possible cyclic ordering, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 4, 3, et cetera, you're going to have these three diagrams, and for these three diagrams, looking at these color-ordered Feynman rules, you'll have 21 terms to deal with.
So these Feynman rules apply to each ordering, each color ordering.
Right. But the advantage is then we don't have to do the color algebra. Okay, so that was color. Color has now disappeared, except that it's left in the sense that we need to keep track of the cyclic ordering. Okay, now the polarization vectors. So in principle, you know, these are the vertices, and then we would, if we were computing from Feynman diagrams, which is attach the polarization vectors, contract them with the external gluons. So we have polarization vectors for positive and negative helicities of gluons orthogonal to the momenta, and then the Gage transformation shifts them for constant W, but there is no natural or even continuous way to choose which in this whole family of gauge-related polarization vectors you're going to use until we introduce spinners. So this is one motivation for replacing the polarization vectors in the spinner helicity formalism. We're going to be able to express them in terms of spinners in a very useful way. So I don't have to assume everybody is familiar with the spinner helicity formalism now, at least from yesterday's talk. Let me just recap some of the key points. So all our momenta, all our on-shell momenta, which for now are the external momenta, momenta of the gluons, can be replaced by spinner pairs. We just where these spinner indices run from 1 to 2. Just to be explicit, let me write down how you might represent these spinners in terms of components if you needed to. Important formula relating the spinner products to a familiar Lorentz inner product. Is that okay? So is it all right if I leave it here? Or are there more questions on the spinner helicity formalism that I should review at this point? I'm just defining the spinners from null moment. Okay, good. While we are on the subject of spinners, let me also write down the very useful Scouten identity for spinner manipulations. So since these spinners are only two component objects, you can usually expand one spinner in a basis of two other spinners. And therefore, there are different ways to write the same expression in terms of spinner products. And this is essentially the key formula that allows you to do it that way. So yeah, the proof is simply, in a nutshell, you take this lambda j, expand it in terms of lambda k and lambda l, if they're not proportional to each other, so that the basis is complete. And then you contract with lambda k and lambda l in turn, solve for the coefficients, and you will recover this formula. Okay, with spinners now we can write down, I should do it here, what the polarization vectors should be. So for P, given by lambda tilde, its two polarization vectors can be written as follows. So the negative one, you take the lambda spinner belonging to P and you just take any other spinner of the opposite chirality, mu tilde, so there is still, you know, some kind of gauge choice involved here, and that's reflected in the freedom to choose Mutilda. The only choice we're not allowed to make is the one that makes the denominator vanish. So it's not directly proportional to lambda tilde, in the sense of its two component spinners. Okay, and then the other one is the conjugate of this. So here we take lambda tilde from the momentum in question, and now we have an arbitrary mu spinner. All right, so now we're equipped with our Feynman rules, color-ordered Feynman rules, and polarization vectors written in terms of spinners. Now we can start computing some amplitudes in compact forms. Ones are the ones that vanish, where all velocities are equal. And so there is a supersymmetry argument for the vanishing of these amplitudes, but we can also see it directly from the Feynman diagrams at this point. So why would this vanish? Well, we look at the polarization vectors that we're going to attach to these diagrams, and we also consider the structure of the interaction vertices. So why do these vanish? Because the endpoint amplitude has at most n minus 2 vertices. So I mean, at most n minus 2 cubic vertices. And each cubic vertex contributes from one power of the momentum. That means that every term in your whole amplitude that can be compute from diagrams has some epsilon dot epsilon contraction somewhere in it. So you don't have enough momenta in the vertices to be able to contract with all the polarization vectors. Therefore, there are some pair of polarization vectors in every term that are directly contracted with each other. Okay, well, and they also mostly have the same helicity. So we see that epsilon I, epsilon j, if they're both positive helicity, is equal to 0 if we choose those arbitrary mu's to have the same value. And we're free to do that because we can choose any mu we want. So the all plus amplitude is already 0 because you just choose for all of them some mu that's the same for all of them and is not equal to lambda for any of them. Now for the other one, we can also make a choice. So the epsilon 1 minus dot epsilon j plus is 0 if we choose mu j to be equal to lambda 1. So we can do that as well. For this amplitude here, for every gluon that's not number 1, we choose its mu to be equal to lambda 1. And for lambda 1 Oh, no, so, yeah, that satisfies all those conditions, and you're set. So it's clear also from the properties of the spinner products, right, that if you try to take the spinner product of two identical spinners, that's zero. So that's what's going on here.
So this is clear? Really a particular choice of gauge.
Yes. So this is a gauge in which you can see the vanishing at the diagram level.
So can you see this in the ordinary Feynman?
No, if you choose the wrong gauge, then it's not going to cancel diagram by diagram. It would only be the sum.
Or in other words, in that language, what is this choice of gauge correspond to?
In what language?
Or in the ordinary Feynman diagram.
Oh, what would we call it?
That's really part of the point. Is that?
Oh, yeah.
Actually, space cone gauge.
Space cone gauge is the term. Sorry, did you have a comment?
The light cone gauge is the same quantization axis, that's it.
Yeah.
Less and more than that.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're always talking about three amplitudes here?
Yes. Oh, yes, and I should also add, of course, that n equals 3 is the special case, because for n equals 3, you can check you're not allowed to make this choice, because for n equals 3, we've seen you have this condition from momentum conservation. Either all the lambdas are proportional or all the lambda tildes are proportional. Therefore, this choice you try to make turns out to be the choice that's specifically forbidden in the definitions of polarization vectors. So it breaks down for n equals 3, but for n greater than 3. Moreover, yeah, for n equals 3, I mean, with these formulas, you can also just compute the three-point amplitude now directly. I take this vertex, those polarization vectors, attach them, you've got the Park-Taylor formula already. Other questions? Okay, in the spirit of computing amplitudes, and we'll compute more later, I'm sticking just with the four-point example. Now, so already now with 1980s technology, we can have enough information to proceed. We can make some convenient gauge choices just to make most of the diagrams drop out. So this is in the spirit of this choice. If you have two gluons of the same helicity and you choose the same mu, then their contraction will be zero. So in fact, with this choice, and then also with a particular choice of lambda 4 tilde and lambda 1 here, then the only epsilon dot epsilon contraction that's non-zero will be 2 with 3. So we had the three diagrams in principle that I wrote down earlier. So, okay, this one vanishes immediately because, well, there are no momenta at all in the interaction vertex, right? So this has two epsilon contracted pairs. Since there's only one that's non-zero, there's no chance of getting anything here. Here as well, we just have to look at actually this vertex And at that vertex, you already see that the three, each of the three terms that could contribute is already becoming zero because of our gauge choice. So, because we chose for epsilon 4, mu 4 to be equal to lambda 1, and epsilon 4, of course, dot p 4 is zero from the start, so that's all zero. Now, of course.
What's p 4 1 the notation?
Oh, that's p 4 plus p 1. Yeah, maybe this is a good point. So in so I have all my momenta outgoing. And I'll use this kind of notation. So capital P with some subscripts will be just the sum of the momenta associated to those gluons. Okay, so something's going to be non-zero. And if you work this out, which I will not do here in detail, although there is detail in the Dixon lectures, then eventually with not very directly, you can recover the Park-Taylor formula. So some of the terms here will drop out thanks to your gauge choice. Like three of them or so survive, and they'll be combined into this form. So now we can already start computing amplitudes in fairly nice forms, and we can start to use some established identities among these objects. But first, simply, there's the reflection identity. If you invert your whole plane, or equivalently reverse the trace, of course, you just pick up a factor of minus 1. Then there's parity conjugation. Allowing us to reverse all the helicities. And that just exchanges the two types of spinner products. With the minus 1 to the n. We've seen also there's a little group scaling. Then the U1 decoupling. So then there are a few now that are less immediately obvious. So this comes now from color considerations. This is the first in a family. So this is for tree level. The upper ones are more general. And what this allows us to do is to sort of cycle one of the gluons through the other ones in the cyclic ordering. the proof of this would come from looking at how, or the fact that these are color-ordered partial amplitudes, and going back to the trace, and again considering the difference between SUN and UN, and the fact that the UN photon does not couple to the gluon, so hence the UN decoupling identity. But this just gives us now, at this level, a relation among the partial amplitudes that you can use to, well, to derive some of them from others and therefore not have to compute each partial amplitude separately.
Sorry, looking at the electrical correlation, what's the symbol on the right-hand side, minus 2, HI?
HI, the helicity. Plus or minus 1. Although, well, I mean, you can use this same formula for the whole multiple. Okay, and then there are other ones that I won't write down, only by name, also derived from color considerations, or proved from string theory techniques. They've been discovered. There's the Kleiss-Kauf, and then there's the Bern-Carrasco-Johansson. Identities. In a nutshell, they are similar to this in that they relate, they give you an identity that relates to different permutations of the gluons inside. And so by the time with the BCJ identities now, you would find that, in fact, you only have n minus 3 factorial independent partial amplitudes, just to get an idea of the counting. So Kleiss-Kauf brought it down to n minus 2 factorial, and now it's n minus 3 factorial. And I guess from string theory arguments, that's probably the best we're going to be able to do in terms of numbers.
That's a true Little statement?
Yes.
Is there an analog in L loops?
I would say no. So now let's just do a bit of calculation to try to get comfortable with these spinner manipulations. Yes?
What's the flavor of the string theory argument that says it is
the flavor? There should be.
I think if you read the papers, it'll be pretty clear it's not intuitive.
Well, you could say that you have 3 points you can fix on.
And yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So,
in the term, right.
Okay.
Right, comes from 10 minus 3.
Yeah. Thanks.
It's actually a translation of the BCJ back.
Also, what it means independent?
Well, they're related by these linear equations.
Because if I count the color configuration, it's only 3 to the n, or 9 to the n, depending on how you count. So for large n, this is much smaller than.
Yeah.
So, what sense do they have?
Well, these are different objects, right? And so they only have the kinematics. I would say we find it, as we say, as we go on, especially through these weeks, right, we'll discover that these partial amplitudes are the ones that are related to each other in many interesting ways, not just by these linear relations, but they have all kinds of mathematical structure that makes it sort of useful to try to target these in the first place.
So that's just... means that not all of them will appear in actual calculations, because...
No, they do.
Yeah. So then I
different. They are different representations.
There are kinematic factors.
In the BCJ, there are kinematic factors, yes. In the Kleist cuff, it's still plus and minus one.
Can you remind me, is the going down to n minus, is the just the literal counting to go down to n minus three factorial, is that exhausted by the so-called bonus relations? Or is there more, purely for the purpose of this counting, is there more in the literal packaging of that information in BCJ? In other words, if I just use U1 decoupling identity and bonus relations, I thought that's already enough to get you down to n minus three factorial, just in counting.
Yeah, I believe so. But okay.
So that's the answer to that.
Now there are other interesting aspects of the BCJ relations besides the fact that you only n minus three independent.
Right. Yes. BCJ.
And yeah, what's most interesting about them is their relations to the color structure and therefore their usefulness in building group amplitudes, for example. But yes, okay, in terms of counting, they do get you down to n minus three factorial, which bonus relations will as well, and also the intuitive string theory arguments. All right, so a little bit of spinner calculations. We've seen the Park-Taylor formula. And we can also write down the parity conjugate of the Park-Taylor formula for what would then be called MHV bar, or anti-MHV amplitudes. Now again, in my favorite case of n equals 4, we can use either one. We have the MHV version. Have the MHB bar version. I don't need to write down the general Park-Taylor formula again, right? I think each one of you could do this on the board as well. So, of course, these are supposed to be equal, and let's just see that explicitly. So in terms of spinners, remember we're going to use conservation of momentum. And then translate these kinds of products back to spinner products. There's a factor of 1/2 here and going, oh, no, there isn't, because there was a factor of 2 in the dot product. So that's the same. All right, so let's just do some manipulations on this expression. Multiply and divide by some convenient spinner product. And now I can replace the numerator using this identity. And let me just, reorder the denominator factors a little bit. Okay, so I can already cancel this factor here. And then I will use momentum conservation some more. So of course, yeah, these amplitudes do include the delta function always for momentum conservation. And as we saw yesterday, sometimes that plays an important role to keep track of that delta function. It will not in my talks, but I will be using momentum conservation for sure. So here, for example, so there are different ways to write this. I guess, okay. Yeah, I didn't write this too explicitly in defining a spinner helicity formalism. Let me start again. I'm going to make this completely clear. I can insert sort of a complete set of these vectors from momentum conservation inside any spinner product. And that's zero, because this is the sum of momenta. Now, the spinner products with equal entries, so 3, 3, and the 1, 1, are zero. So what I have here is this. Now, another way I will write these kinds of spinner products that are stuck together is, okay, let me write 1, 2, 2, 3. I might write this in terms of the vector. So this is a definition. If I write sometimes this is written with a slash to represent the contraction of gamma matrices. Although that's more for the four-component spinner formalism. So if I use this kind of notation, then I could also have written, I've just done explicitly the momentum conservation relation in vector form. Here, I would have canceled the one and the three for the same reason, and then been left with this one, P4, three. Which I could then expand back in terms of spinners because P4 is one of my null momenta. So I hope this is clear because pretty soon I'll be going pretty quickly from this with a minus sign. This becomes 1, 4. 4, 3, and here, for the same reason, like another minus sign, this becomes 4, 3, 3, 2, and then I still have the 1, 2. Got it? All right, and now these factors cancel as well. And now, just we're using the anti-symmetry on 1, 4, and 3, 2, I've recovered the expression on the right-hand side. Okay, any questions? This is the warm-up, and the next topic will be BCFW recursion. Should I continue now, or should we?
Is there like 10 minutes or so?
Yeah, there's just the the general setup, and I won't compute anything until this afternoon, and then this afternoon I will also talk about some other applications, like bonus relations and different kinds of shifts. CFW recursion relations or construction. Yeah, so at this level, it's general and possibly familiar. So I'd say it's important points. It's an on-shell technique. It's going to be gauge invariants, and now we're going to compute amplitudes without making any clever gauge choices. The common element is a linear shift in complex momentum space. We get compact formulas directly. And the construction is from the residue theorem. So we start by considering our amplitude just as a function of the momenta. So assuming we're working with some given helicity amplitude, so it's a function, well, really of, say, the spinners. But for the moment, I'm not even necessarily assuming that these are massless particles. So let me just write it like that. And then I let them all depend on some complex variable z. And I will want to let them depend on z eventually in such a way that everything stays on shell, so this is where the complex momenta will be key. And in such a way that overall momentum is still conserved. Now, if we are so lucky as to have defined A of Z in such a way that it goes to zero as z goes to infinity, so this is a big if, which we'll have to check if that's true or not, then, or rather construct a of z so that it is true, hopefully, then this contour integral is zero. Where the contour is large enough to enclose all finite poles. And this then, by the residue theorem, is the sum of residues, so you have one at A of zero, plus residues from all the other poles labeled by, say, z pi. And this is our original amplitude. So I didn't say, okay, when z equals zero, we want to define this shift in such a way that when z equals zero, then you get sort of the amplitude you're really interested in. And you introduce the dependence. And then this will turn out to have the form of a recursion relation. So we see this is expressed in terms of something, and this will in turn be expressed in terms of lower point tree level amplitudes. So we use normally a simple linear shift, which is denoted by a hat. So a hat on top of the variable means shifted momentum. So pj of z is just pj plus z times some other vector q. So far, arbitrary. Okay, and then, no, this is just one j. So first I choose j. I'm shifting one momentum right now. So yeah, now of course I want to conserve overall momentum, so things are going to make sense as amplitudes. And so the simplest choice is to absorb the shift in one other particle. So then there will be some k. Which also has a hat, which has the compensating shift. And for all the other ones, pi of z will just be equal to pi, not shifted. Coming to that right now. So far I haven't said this is on shell. So far I've just done a momentum conserving shift. Yeah, now we want to request that they also be on shell. So we want pj hat squared plus pj squared plus mj squared, whatever the mass is. And the same for pk. Okay, so that means that imposes a condition on Q. We choose Q to satisfy Q squared equals zero and Q dot PJ and Q dot PK equals zero.
Okay, so I'm asking if P hat squared, there's no complex conjugate at all. It's just p hat times p hat, not p hat times p hat star.
Right.
Is it obvious why?
Well, that's just how we would define the product in complex momentum space.
Because ultimately it's p squared, not p times p star. It appears in the
when you go to zero, p hat star is the same as p squared. When z goes
just how you analytically
do it. You want an analytic function.
All right, so these conditions have two solutions with complex values. So if we want to do this, we're stuck in complex momentum space. So what about the poles? And I need to look at this term and see that it looks something like amplitudes. So the poles come from propagators. Now we have to, we're going to let go of Feynman diagrams. We have to remember where these amplitudes are coming from. We have some rational functions involved, and the denominators are the propagators, and the numerators come from the interaction vertices. So the poles, the only z dependence comes from the momentum dependence in the denominator, which is all in the form of familiar propagators. And, well, not just any propagator either, but the one separating j and k in the tree. So yeah, let me make it clear, I am certainly at tree level here. So we have tj hat over here, PK hat as well. Let me call this momentum flowing through this propagator PR, or momentum going to the right. There is, so the formula that will involve both PR with and without a hat. So PR without the hat is the original version. With a hat would be defined so as to conserve momentum with the hats on P hat, PK and PJ. Now, so the Z dependence sort of flows in the tree from these two, from one of the two shifted legs to the other one. So the propagators in between them in the tree graph will depend on Z, and the other ones will not, because we just have exactly the opposite shift. So PR of Z equals PR minus ZQ. And we can pick up a pole, well, where this goes on shell. Z pi PR squared minus M squared over 2Q dot PR. Now at this value of Z pi, where we have the pole, the propagator is going on shell, that's what makes the denominator go to zero, giving us a pole, but that also means that, I mean, that this is really going on shell in a sense. That's why we have now amplitudes on the left and the right of this picture. Amplitudes, because this has gone on shell, and these were continued in such a way that they remained on shell. ZQ. No, yeah, this is just ZQ, because this is just inherits the shift from PK.
Yeah, maybe you should have explained why J is on the left and K is on the right.
Why? Well, I explained why they have to be on different sides. And then, okay, so all my momenta are going outwards, right? So that's why this one has the same sign as PK. Is that clear? Anything else to it?
I think Aaron's question was that.
Yeah, I was confused because I looked like I had ZQ flowing out here and minus Z flowing out here. And so I would have thought that I would have two Z to balance that, but I guess.
No, the shift is flowing like from here to here or the other way around. So we have a whole tree graph.
Incoming everywhere. All the momentum.
Outgoing. Yeah. Yeah, that's the point. Okay, except here, of course, where I have to make a choice. But then, okay. So this residue, Z equals Z pi, is really a product of amplitude. So I write them with my capital A. And it's just the usual propagator in the middle. So this then is the recursion relation. I've expressed the original amplitude in terms of a sum like this. And in the sum, you have two tree level amplitudes. And the sum is over essentially all the propagators along the path from J to K. Wait one second. And in the case of fermions, you would modify the propagator accordingly.
Just, I didn't understand. The graphs would have the PJ and PK together?
Those.
Well, OK, what I'm really doing is you have your whole graph, right? And somewhere in the graph, there is a path from J to K, right? And along the path, there's other stuff. But so I've shifted the momentum here, and then it's going to come out over here. But momentum conservation, I'm just following this path, and every propagator along here is picking up either plus or minus ZQ, depending on how it's oriented. And all the propagators off the path are not affected because they have the compensating shift on those two sides of the path.
It might be some contribution where J and K are in the same vertex.
But there's no Z. In any factorization,
yeah, that's important that because there is no Z, and then the requirement that alpha z goes to zero is not anymore satisfied.
Then there's no contribution there. I mean, yeah, if they join the same vertex, J and K, yeah, then the shifted momentum just comes out. Then there's no pull.
There is no Z dependence in this term.
There's no Z dependence.
Right.
Which means that the set is configured in terms of branch is infinity. This is what he is saying.
The point is that by
some... Oh.
The rule
is, yeah, so this is something we'll have to check.
This something is important.
There's an infinite.
Yes. And we'll definitely come back to this in the afternoon. When is this... Well, at least we'll show it's true for gluon amplitude to discuss some conditions.
But there's no restriction on where the particles are.
There is a restriction. You continue two particles that are isolated by sigma.
No, you can continue any one the heck you want. As long as that condition is satisfied,
this condition is not satisfied when they're closed.
That's incorrect.
No, it is.
Condition is satisfied.
Well, I'll prove it this afternoon.
but the point is, given that it vanishes at infinity, then the only poles that occur, the only poles that occur in the pictures are withdrew with J and K separate.
He will prove that in later.
Yeah. Oh, so actually, that's it for now, because I've arrived at the recursion relation. We'll pick it up this afternoon.